Does anyone have anything funny to share from their Memorial Day weekend?
I fell asleep by the pool and got sunburned.
I was enjoying a wonderful day in the park and someone threw up next to me. For like a long time.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Thank you to Micah for filling in for me last week. Did you miss me?
I missed you terribly because I hate hosting.
And I also hope that everyone had a good Memorial Day. We've got plenty to talk about today. First off, a recent poll showed that in head-to-head matchups, former Vice President Joe Biden would beat each of his high-profile Democratic rivals. That's been used to suggest that there may not be a consensus anti-Biden candidate. But is that a good use of polling? We'll get into that. Also, last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi amped up criticism of President Trump as she tamped down calls for impeachment from within her own caucus. According to reports, it's part of a larger strategy on her part, which we're also going to get into. And here with me to do all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
It's going well. You know, we've already been talking for like 10 minutes, so I feel like...
He feels warm.
Warmed up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 10 minutes of content listeners will never hear. That's for the best. Also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
It's good. Hey, Galen.
Hey. And managing editor Micah Cohen, how are you?
Very good.
Also on today's podcast, the Democratic National Committee announced some new rules for how the first Democratic primary debates will be structured. That's debates plural, because of course there are too many candidates to have just one debate. So we're going to lay out what those new rules mean for the candidates. But of course, let's begin with good use of polling or bad use of polling. So here's what happened. Last week, Republican polling firm Echelon Insights released a poll in which they pitted Biden against Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg, and Warren in hypothetical head-to-head matchups. The results showed Biden leading all of those candidates by big margins. So Sanders did the best against Biden, but he was still trailing him by 36 points. For the rest, Biden's margin was in the 40s, and essentially this gets at what might happen to Biden's front-runner position once the field winnows more. And as a Vox subheadline read, quote, a new poll suggests there might not be an anti-Biden vote to consolidate. All right, so before we get into how exactly this poll is being interpreted, Nate, is the underlying poll that we're looking at a quality poll?
Sure. It's a guy who's a mostly Republican consultant. I mean, they haven't done a ton of horse race polling, but there'd be no real reason to critique that.
So then is the interpretation that this new poll suggests that there might not be an anti-Biden vote to consolidate, is that a good use of this poll? Is that what this says?
Yes.
All right.
Next segment. Biden is really popular. I think that, like, except for certain segments of Democratic Twitter or the left or whatever, however mergers you have between those, you know, only around 15% of Democrats have a negative view of Biden. And so there isn't like an anti-Biden vote per se, or at least not that much of one. I don't know. I was kind of a little surprised by how well he held up in these one-on-one matchups. But it kind of goes to show that, like, it's not just this kind of... So in 2016, Trump had a thing where actually there were a lot of Republicans who disliked him at various stages of the primary. And so there you would say, well, Trump might be leading the field, but... In a one-on-one between Trump and our hero, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Rubio would come close to Trump, or Ted Cruz would come close to Trump in a head-on-head matchup. You know, this suggests that Biden is more formidable than that. Although, of course, Trump won, so I don't know how you how that reverberates onto this, right? But it does mean that, like... That,
so
like,
you would be suggesting that Biden is in even better position than Trump would have been at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I'll put it like this. Biden's lead... is not just a reflection of the divided field. And in some ways, the fact that Biden has 35 or whatever percent, when you have so many candidates, I'll tell you that in the first place, whereas Trump at this point had, you know, not this point, at this point he wasn't running yet, but Trump, after his initial surge, had 20, 25%. Biden is doing better than that, and his numbers hold up better when other candidates drop out. And so that's like a very bearish bullet point for the other Democratic candidates.
Well, as you mentioned, right, at this point in 2016, Trump hadn't even entered the race yet, which suggests that we are a far way out from voting 8 months about. Also, different candidates have different levels of name recognition. So is this kind of head-to-head polling this far out? Also, of course, the primary isn't an actual head-to-head matchup. Is it meaningful?
I guess I'll be the broken record and say it is pretty early. There haven't been debates. Joe Biden is still pretty new to the race. He honestly hasn't had that many. You know, he's been on The View. He's had some national media stuff. But he hasn't been doing tons and tons of, like, you know, I'm out there, I'm in front of all the cameras constantly. He's sort of, you know, doing like an early stages. I'm doing fundraising events. I don't do public events every day. You know, his schedule isn't always in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina. To me, it's kind of like, this is a super interesting poll. I think it's useful to have head-to-head polling like this early on, you know, if only because we can, over the following months, see changes. But it's also early.
Yeah, that's more where I am, where I'm not really sure how much to make of this. One is like, all right, so Biden goes from, in the poll of like everybody, he has what, it's like upper 30s% to like low 60s, mid 60s in one-on-one matchup. So he's gaining, you know, 20 or so percentage points of support. That still leaves about anywhere from a third to 40% of the party who's not saying Biden. So I'm not sure that's an anti-Biden block, but that's a big share of the party.
But he's not a factional candidate.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah,
Trump was, and again, Trump proves that you can win as a factional candidate. Well, he was. I mean, Trump represented a kind of, I don't know how you want to describe it, probably a couple different factions, actually. Partly like kind of a Tea Party faction, partly like an anti-establishment faction, partly, frankly, a xenophobic, and united those. Whereas Biden is someone who has a lot of cross-party appeal, except to kind of some highly informed voters on the left, and they're a constituency that I think is like overrated on Twitter because they overlap a lot with kind of coastal elite circles.
Well, but I think what we learned in the end was, you know, Trump may have appealed to multiple factions, but I think you just named like every faction in the Republican Party. So in the end, like, you know, he may have started as a factional candidate, but I think what we expected in 2016, which was, oh, the anti-Trump vote will consolidate, didn't happen. And Trump just kind of creeping up. So if you want to use this data to say, oh, Biden has a lot of cross-party appeal, I think that's totally right. I guess what I'm saying, though, is I don't think this disproves the notion that there's this chunk on the left that is not on board with Biden. How big that is, how important that is, I think is up for debate. But
right. I don't know that anybody is necessarily making the argument that Biden is the Trump of 2020, except in that, you know, he's leading in polls, right?
Right.
But in looking at this specific poll, there are different levels of support. When you say that, oh, Biden's advantage is in the 40s, a 40-point margin, it's also including people who are saying, oh, I would probably vote for Joe Biden if he was up against Elizabeth Warren. For example, that's 25% of those people say they would probably vote for him. So this isn't, again, like set in stone, right?
Well, yeah, look, it's early. That's absolutely true. And again, as much as I think that Biden is the most likely candidate to win, he's under 50%. And so most times the primary ends with someone else overtaking him at some point. Slowly or quickly or whatever else. But if you think that Biden is leading only because the field is so divided, that's not true. He would also be leading by a pretty big margin right now if there were any combination of two candidates. I would have loved, by the way, to see these numbers for Bernie because he is a little bit more of a factional candidate. Did they publish those? I guess not, right? But like, how would Bernie do versus Cory Booker or something one-on-one? I would be curious about.
Echelon Insights for your next poll. Look that up. As we wrap up here, Claire, does it seem like there's an obvious choice if there was going to be an anti-Biden candidate at this point that people who don't particularly like Biden would rally around?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I actually thought it was interesting that in that poll, Harris had sort of pulled ahead a bit behind, you know, to third place behind Biden and Sanders. I mean, I do think Sanders, we talked a little bit in the past couple of podcasts about how Sanders saw a big sort of drop off of support once Biden got into the race. And you have seen, you know, these news cycles in the past week or so talking about his pro-Sandinistas views in the 80s. And, you know, you could see other candidates perhaps in the debates maybe pointing to that as, listen, do you want that guy in the general election to be in debates for Trump to be able to point to him saying he supported an anti-U.S. movement, blah, blah, blah. The short answer to your question, though, is no. I think it's still kind of like an interesting, a lot of people are kind of hovering in the second tier.
Do you have a sense, Micah?
I'm not sure I have sort of original thoughts on this, in that I think the anti-Biden candidate is going to be, you know, someone from the left. I think that makes total sense. And it is a case where, you know, the last time we talked about lanes was like several months ago, and in the data there wasn't much evidence of lanes yet. I think you're starting to see a little more evidence of lanes come through in the polling. So I do think like Sanders or Warren or someone from that wing of the party, you know, would make a lot of sense.
You know what lanes there are, man? There's the winner's lane and the loser's lane. Right now, Joe Biden's in the winner's lane.
And with that, let's move on to the back and forth between Pelosi and Trump last week, and what unnamed sources are describing as an overarching strategy. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspaces for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork spaces are designed to maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses that intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, or Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible, and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. WeWork's floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams, perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. WeWork pays special attention to the culture and energy of each of their locations, and they're designed to foster amazing partnerships and collaborations both within teams and across companies. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you and learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper Mattress. Memorial Day is the unofficial start to summer, and with how hot it's already been for many of us, we can officially welcome back sweating through the night, tossing and turning, and not sleeping. Sure, running the AC or a fan all night can help a bit, but to really sleep cool and comfortable, get rid of your heat-trapping mattress and get a Casper. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night, all summer long. Casper has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try out your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper. Go to casper.com/politics right now, and you'll get 10% off any purchase with a mattress today. That's casper.com/politics to save 10% on any purchase that includes a mattress. Additional fees may apply for Hawaii and Alaska. See casper.com/terms for additional terms and conditions. Limit one code per customer, and it cannot be combined with any other offer. All right, last week things got heated between Speaker Pelosi and President Trump in a way they haven't really before. She said that he is, quote, engaged in a cover-up, and that she wishes his family or staff would, quote, have an intervention for the good of the country. He called her, quote, crazy Nancy, saying she's a mess and she's lost it, and that she doesn't understand the trade deal with Canada and Mexico. All the while, Pelosi was working to convince her caucus to go slow on the issue of impeachment. So here's what the Times reported about basically what happened last week. And I'm quoting, "The collision was anything but accidental. Ms. Pelosi set out Thursday morning to pick a fight with Mr. Trump, three people close to her said." And then they go on, the Times goes on to say, quote, "Her decision to dramatize the fight also represented an embrace of Mr. Trump's own signature political tactic, an attempt to divert attention from a divisive internal debate, in this case, a drive by two dozen of her caucus members to push ahead with impeachment," end quote. So is it fair to characterize what happened last week between Trump and Pelosi as basically Pelosi trying to pick fights with the president in order to distract from the issue of impeachment, or to like substitute impeachment, being like, I'll be antagonistic, but we're not going to impeach him?
Sure. If you trust the reporting, that's kind of the picture it paints. Is I'm not sure it's a distraction so much as she wants her caucus to feel like she's not being soft on Trump. That's reportedly why she comes out with the cover-up line and kind of goes after him. I think that makes a fair amount of sense.
Everyone else buying the narrative?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, they literally, like, there's literally sources close to Pelosi, which is probably like her top aides, her
Pansy Pelosi,
saying that this is a thing. Like, I gotta say, I had no time for this whenever it happened, like Thursday.
Oh, I love this story.
Oh my God, I hated this. I was also working on something else, but I just found the day just like stupid and exhausting, and it felt very reminiscent of like the first quarter of Trump's presidency, yeah, when everyone was like losing their mind at every single press conference that happened, or every Sarah Sanders press conference that happened. It was just, and I was like, I mean, it's sure, it's smart on Pelosi's part. It's like very bread and circuses for the masses being in part the Democratic base and in part her caucus who want her to do something. But like ultimately, it's kind of like sound and fury signifying nothing except for just like the endless play. Fine. Like, next.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I want to make an argument for why I find this interesting, but I'm not sure I know why.
Well,
I mean, interesting.
I guess first of all, does this mark any significant strategy change for Democrats?
Like, and I guess I'm not sure if I find it to be a shift. By the way, can I make a little scolding media point?
It's your brand, so go for it.
If right. I said no, would you not?
Actually, I don't think you should be able to say sources close to X if the source is actually X. I think that's totally misleading.
That's also conjecture that it is actually Nancy Pelosi.
I'm sure sometimes in the history of sources close to X, the source is X.
Okay.
I don't know about
in any case. Okay. Go ahead with your other point.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I really see it as a big turning point. I think it was kind of a slow news week, and so therefore people like pay more attention to it. I mean, I'm not sure that Pelosi's strategy isn't to like goad Trump into being combative, a bit like with the shutdown, right? Pelosi might not want impeachment, but you'd probably do want the president doing rash and unpopular things. And by the way, Trump's approval rating, I don't know if we should make too much of this. It is like a little bit of a lower ebb than it has been. It's back down to 41.
That was after it went up a bit, right?
Not in our average very much. A competitor of ours who shall not be named, who has, we think, introduces noise into their approval rating average based on which mix of polls happens to be included, had showed a surge for Trump. And we shut him up to 42 or 43, I think, and now it's down to 41.5 or something. These are not like hugely big shifts, but like, look, politically, Democrats' end game should be to make Trump unpopular, which seems like totally obvious, right? But you would rather have Trump's approval rating drop to 38%, and then you have lots of options, including if you were to pursue impeachment, it might become more popular at that point.
So you're saying that the strategy is set Trump off in order to make him less popular. But like, does anything that Trump did on Thursday or Friday or whatever, does that show a new image of President Trump to the American public, one they haven't seen before, and make them reconsider what they were thinking when he was at 42%?
No, but the American public doesn't like President Trump by and large, and they like him better when he is being less involved with the daily news cycle and the tweets and everything else, and just steps back and manages an economy they think is very good right now, right? And so the more, and by the way, infrastructure is one of the few areas where plausibly you could have seen a bipartisan bill being passed. Democrats probably wouldn't want that from a pure political calculation standpoint because it would potentially make Trump more popular. And so therefore to have an excuse not to have to pursue that is fairly effective from a cynical standpoint. And also the fact that like now, because Trump says, I will refuse to negotiate with these guys while they're investigating me, you know, that isn't an excuse the public's going to like very much. And so all of a sudden now he took the onus off of Pelosi to try and come up with some compromise on infrastructure.
Well, let's pull back. What was the point of the last 4 days of news cycle? Truly.
I asked that question like literally half a time.
No, but I think we should like interrogate this, right? Because ostensibly the event was about infrastructure, right? A thing that the American people want to happen and that a lot of people agree we need. But both sides, I mean, Trump left the meeting for a preordained press conference, right? He had slogans up in front of his podium. Pelosi, as we know from this reporting, kind of planned to bait him or whatever, wasn't really serious about it. So what you have is like, it's a pseudo event, right? On both sides. It's a falsified event masquerading under the pretense of a real thing. And then we've had 4 days of news about the pretense thing when the whole idea of it is, I mean, it's really about impeachment and not about infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. But we all just have to be polite and say it's about infrastructure.
I said infrastructure one time segment.
Well,
but
it's fed. I mean, it's done what it meant to do, right? Which is feed 4 days of news cycles about how tactical Nancy Pelosi is and how, you know, if you believe like Masha Gessen at The New Yorker, America's politics have become completely Trumpified, as if this marks some, you know, turning point in everything. But it really has just done what we've done for the past 2.5 years, which is feed, you know, move it forward a few days, go into the Memorial Day session, get people talking about this and not something else. And it's like, you know, listeners, readers of newspapers, what was the point of it all? I don't know.
Political gain.
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess that, I'm just saying, like, we should, yeah. like, it's artifice.
Oh, it's definitely artifice. But I guess what I like about it is that it played out in, like, physical space, in that
it was a play.
It didn't
he
happen.
Felt like he was at the theater.
Wait, didn't happen in the Matrix this time?
Yeah, no. Normally what it is like, Trump gives a press conference or just makes remarks to reporters, and Pelosi or whoever the antagonist is does the same thing. And it all kind of plays out at a distance. And so any time where the participants are going somewhere and interacting, it's a little more interesting to me.
Did it matter to anyone besides her congressional caucus and people who read political news? Like, did the past 4 days of events and news cycle have anything to do with the American electorate and voters?
Okay, no is the short answer. But if this whole, and I agree it's artifice, but if all this artifice had the effect of tamping down the movement in Pelosi's caucus mm-hmm. for impeachment, I'm not sure it did, but let's say it did. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of theory of this. Then sure, then it matters, because then there's less of a move for impeachment.
Fair. Yeah. I guess I just think it's sort of fascinating that people got so into this one particular thing.
I think we should also, Nate said something that's worth questioning a little bit more, which is, beyond just tamping down the calls for impeachment, it may not be in Democrats' best interest to pass an infrastructure bill. Do you agree with that? I mean, is there reason for us to believe that?
Politically, sure. I mean, that's why I don't think this was a shift strategically on Democrats' part, like from, oh, we're going to try to work with Trump to get infrastructure, to, oh, now we're not. My hunch is they never had much desire to pass an infrastructure bill with Trump, because why would you?
Well, the other thing is, it's more of a divide within the Republican Party than it is within the Democratic Party, right? Because the Senate would still be very concerned about public funding of infrastructure, even if Trump got on board with Democrats.
Yeah, but passing something, you know, Trump getting to have a signing ceremony with, like, a big infrastructure bill where we get, you know, the Trump Highway Act or something like that, it would not be good for Democrats politically heading into 2020. I think Nate's right that, you know, we have all sorts of evidence that Trump's approval rating is depressed from where it, quote unquote, should be based on how well the economy is doing and some other stuff. And so the more Democrats can have Trump misbehaving and sort of tweeting out crazy stuff and throwing tantrums, however much artifice it is, the American people don't like that. And so, you know, I think where we are right now is sort of ideal for Democrats, in that it sort of vaguely looks like they wanted an infrastructure deal, but they can plausibly point to Trump and say, hey, he's the reason this got blown up.
So is it always counter to the interests of the opposition party to pass legislature while they're in opposition? Is that just how it works?
Well, so it might be of interest to Democratic members of Congress. So Democratic incumbents in the House would probably be perfectly happy if Trump delivered some shovel-ready project to their district. But it would not be of interest of the Democratic candidates for president for Trump to have this big, popular, bipartisan accomplishment.
And then I think that what's different now, Galen, is I think it was always sort of, I think there was always in an election year some resistance to giving the opposition party a win. But I think that the sort of time frame from which the opposition party is like acting on that urge has expanded, where before you'd hear like, oh, it's an election year, so, you know, that bipartisan thing won't happen. Well, now it sort of doesn't really matter if it's an election year or not. It's just all the time, right?
All right. Well, with that, let's wrap up by looking at how the design for the first Democratic debates is shaping up. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Getting into debt is easy, but getting out of debt is hard, especially if your FICO score isn't great. Sky-high interest rates can make it incredibly hard to break out of the revolving debt cycle. Thankfully, now there's Upstart.com, the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter interest rates to help pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. The best part, once the loan is approved, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 200,000 people have used Upstart to pay off student loans or to make a large purchase. Free yourself from the burden of debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/politics. We are now a month away from the first Democratic primary debates, and last week the Democratic National Committee announced some new rules for how the debates will be set up. We already knew that there were going to be two nights of debates because the number of candidates is so high, but they got more specific about how the top tier candidates will be split up across the two nights. And so basically, instead of having a JV and a varsity debate, they're going to split up those top tier candidates along with the lower tier candidates so that there's a mix on each night. Starting out, what are the overarching qualifying rules for making it into the Democratic primary debates?
You either have to have 65,000 unique donors, or you have to get at least 1% of the vote in at least three polls from a prescribed list of polls the DNC regards as good polls nationally or in the early states. The fine print says that if there are, however, more than 20 candidates who meet one or both of those standards, then there are other rules that apply, beginning with, do you meet both the donors and the polls criterion, and then some ranking of how well you do in the polls. And so, you know, potentially we would not have 22 candidates on stage, even if 22 candidates actually met one criteria. If they met both, then you go by how they rank in the polls, I believe.
So who has qualified so far? Or maybe it's easier to talk about who hasn't qualified so far for the debates.
I'll tell you, everyone who's qualified by polls and donors, okay? Klobuchar, Yang, Sanders, O'Rourke, Booker, Warren, Inslee, Biden, Castro, Harris, Williamson, Buttigieg, Gabbard.
So that's both polls and donors.
And then there's a handful of people who have qualified just by the polls, which is de Blasio, Swalwell, Delaney, Hickenlooper. That's it.
And so they just don't have the 65,000 individual donors. And then is there anybody who got the 65,000 individual donors but doesn't have the polling to qualify?
Not according to our tracking of this.
So who hasn't made it?
The people who have not made it are Wayne Messam, who doesn't even qualify as a major candidate by our definition. Seth Moulton, who does qualify as a major candidate but has not made the debate yet. Michael Bennett, again, major candidate by our definition, has not made the debate. And Mike Gravel, who does not qualify as a major candidate per 538 and has not made the debate.
What we found out last week, essentially, Nate, was that they're going to divvy up the top tier candidates among the two nights. What was the stated goal for why they're doing that?
The stated goal is that, I think as well as the unstated goal, is that you want to avoid having a pileup of the stronger candidates on one night where therefore would feel like the other night was a junior varsity debate.
What's the why?
Well, I think it's stupid. But I think if you're the DNC, then you're trying to look like you're being fair to all the Swalwells.
Well, maybe you want people to watch both nights. Or
and maybe
more
cynically, you want people to watch both nights, yeah.
So you think that's why they're doing this, keep focus on both nights of debate?
I don't really think they've thought this through deeply, and I think we're already seeing, I mean, the whole history of like the presidential primary system is the law of unintended consequences and the history of overcorrecting for last time and therefore creating new problems.
I don't understand.
Like that list Micah read of like the, however many is it, like 13 who have qualified by both, like those should be the only people that are worthy of debating. If you can't, I'm sorry, get 65,000 people donating to you, which Beto O'Rourke, who is not the strongest candidate in the field, got in one day. If you can't hit 1% in three polls also, then you're kind of wasting.
So you're saying that it's that they shouldn't have this many candidates in the first place, that they should have had more stringent requirements to qualify for the debates, right? But like once you have established those parameters, why do you have a problem with splitting it up into why do you have
because I think it's an, I think it's insulting to candidates who are as popular as Biden or Warren or Harris or Bernie to make them debate all these dudes who are just going on running for president so they can get more
right,
time on MSNBC.
Couldn't you make the point that people could have, you know, that if you're the party organ, that you, part of your job is just to facilitate, and there might be people who aren't as well known who have better ideas and they get a television platform.
You can go in your CNN town hall and your Fox News town hall and you can run advertising and you can use your platform to get to, gosh, 1% in the polls, or how about 2%?
No, but we're not talking about qualifying for the debates whatsoever. We're talking about the idea of divvying up top-tier candidates. And so part of the rationale might be like, yeah, this person is not polling so well now, but the whole point of the debate is to get national exposure and make your argument.
Or,
and if you have a JV and varsity and nobody watches the JV debate, then do you just have a situation where you don't help achieve the goal of the debate, which is to give people a national audience?
The one thing I would also say is to, like, Nate, as a former debater, the people who will have who are basically no names have kind of nothing to lose. So don't you think that they might throw harder questions or harder attacks at the top tier people than other top tier people would throw at top tier people, therefore making the debates actually more fruitful
lively.
And lively?
No, I think you'll see a lot of gimmickry and gadget plays. And that people like
sounds complicated.
That's safe for national television. Gadget play.
Is that like, oh, that's a football term. You know what? Gadget, is that like,
doesn't
outdated?
Sound like a football
that doesn't
term.
Sound, I'm not really gadget up to date play. On my football, but that doesn't sound like a football term.
It means like a trick play, right? A stunt. No, I think the purpose of a debate is to force the major candidates to debate one another. And
but,
I think it's to win over the field.
But that's not how they work. I mean, they do work that way sometimes. But like, don't you think you need like someone in there throwing bombs?
There are plenty of them to throw. I mean, again, we're not talking about like we're winning down to five people. There's already like Booker and Klobuchar or whatever, right? You know, they're ones who actually have been senators their whole lives and not just like a two-term congressman or something, right? Who's on MSNBC a lot. Like, they're the ones who should probably get more attention in the debates. They're more popular. They're better credentialed. And I think the DNC is creating all types of perverse incentives for all these random, mediocre white dudes to run for president because it's not very hard to qualify for the debates. And they're exacerbating it by saying, yes, Seth Moulton, if you hit 1% in three random polls.
You're the person, though, who's always talking about how people should try to be more small d democratic
and inclusive.
So,
and
isn't this what this is?
Right. So they can sit at the kids' table, they're in the room, and they go to the kids' table, and you can have that the first night, and then leave two slots open, right? Have a poll, and whichever two candidates from that group do the best, they're invited back the next night to sit at the grown-ups' table. But like, I don't want equal time between, because the range of candidates in terms of credentials and popularity is so broad, right? You know, I don't want equal time for Seth Moulton and Elizabeth Warren, and I don't think voters do either.
But that's ascribing a lot of power to these early polls in which none of the, like a lot of these people don't have name recognition. And sure, people like Swalwell, you can, I think, throw a lot of shit at their credentials. But you also have people like John Hickenlooper. These aren't like, I don't think there's any inherent problem with an overly inclusive and like overly quote unquote fair first debate. You got to remember, this is the first debate.
Yeah, there are going to be 12 of these.
What I would do if I were the DNC is say, okay, I'm going to have an overly inclusive, overly fair first debate, which has some of these issues Nate is talking about, but then slowly ramp it up debate by debate. So then at least you're giving some of these people a platform, but then there's kind of a clear and predetermined winnowing as you go debate to debate. But I don't think I've seen them lay out these later debate criteria, which if I were a campaign, I'd be like, well, what, you know, is this going to be determined after the effect? But I think the first debate, it makes sense that it would be super inclusive.
Can we step back for a second and ask, what is the goal of having primary debates?
The goal of the Democratic Party should be to win elections. That's what the goal of the DNC should be, period. And the extent to which being perceived as fair is important to win elections because different constituencies in the party want to feel represented, and that's important, but it's a means to an end. There are not a bunch of people who are screaming for John Hickenlooper to be treated fairly because he has 1% support in the polls. And by the way, the fact that a Pete Buttigieg or an Andrew Yang or Marianne Williamson, with especially in the latter two cases, very little name recognition, can build a constituency for themselves shows that Hickenlooper doesn't have very many excuses, and that the reason why John Hickenlooper isn't doing better is because he's a bad candidate who does not have a good plan for how to win the primary.
I want you to tell us what you really think.
Yeah, that's but, like so overconfident. With this campaign, for you, feels like it's been going on for a while. Most people haven't even started paying attention yet. There's no downside to having a really inclusive first debate. What's the problem?
I think you're also coming at this from two different places in the sense of, Nate, you're saying that the goal of how the DNC sets up these debates should just be to win elections. And we're asking more the question of, what is the goal of having a debate? It's like, introduce candidates to the nation so that people will be informed and then can therefore vote in the primary and decide who they like, even if they don't know who the person is yet.
Well, and by the way, that all has the added benefit of, I think, making it more likely you'll win the election. The more informed your voters are in evaluating all these candidates and picking the one that they like most, you would think you'd end up with the best candidate, as opposed to, I don't trust the DNC's judgment of who they think is most likely to beat Trump.
It's not. You're looking at the judgment of voters as reflected by polls and donor amounts. I'm just saying that, like, I think those thresholds should be higher because the voters are saying, we are not interested in John Hickenlooper and Eric Swalwell. And every moment that Eric Swalwell talks is a moment that Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar.
But can't they still tighten the debate requirements for the second debate?
That's what I'm saying.
And they will.
I'd agree with all of this in like January 2020. But I think right now you start wide and then you tighten.
I just think, like, as a matter of attitude, that the party shouldn't treat.
They got a bad attitude.
They have a bad, yeah.
No, I think it's an interesting. I think Nate is making an interesting argument. I immediately think of, like, when people used to think that there shouldn't be direct election of U.S. senators, that that people should winnow for.
It's kind of not what I'm saying, though. I'm saying it's like you have five or six candidates that people really like and another four or five candidates that they've shown a fair amount of curiosity about. And to try and get them to all have meaningful interactions with one another, those top 10 or 12, is already pretty hard. It's already a fairly large field. And then you're being overly gracious to the Eric Swalwells of the world. That's not what the voters want.
My point applies because you're actually having like different interpretations of democracy. Obviously, like the DNC is like a club, right? It's not a federal election, but the idea that it's like representative democracy versus some simulation of more direct democracy, and the DNC is trying to do a simulation of more direct democracy.
How about this? The candidates are announced in random order. And they give like a 15-second speech. I'm Joe Biden. I'm running for U.S. president. I used to be a senator from Delaware. And by the way, the vice president. And then voters in the debate hall, by a show of hands, either give thumbs up or thumbs down. The candidates who give thumbs up to are allowed to proceed to the debate. The ones for thumbs down fall into like a pit of alligators and are devoured.
Well, who's sitting in the audience, I guess, would be the next question.
A randomly selected panel of likely
Roman
voters,
emperors.
Likely voter Democrats.
It's just Nate.
It's just Nate. Okay, so wrapping up here, there's been a lot of like heated attention given to how this debate is designed. Do we know how much of an impact these debates have on primaries? Like, I'm sure there's been political science research done.
Primary debates, I think, have the potential to have more effect than general election debates because there's not partisanship to override everything else. But the effect are usually fleeting, I think studies have found. But I don't know, it's like this will be the second field now where we've had 200 candidates. So I'm not sure that it's safe to conclude we know all that much about what role debates play in winnowing or otherwise affecting such a big field.
So debates can serve as focal points or focusing points, maybe is more precise, where they direct the conversation around certain candidates. Because look, if you want to be honest, like this news cycle last week and into this weekend, 3-day weekend, it's a really unfocused news cycle. There's not a lot happening.
There's UFOs.
There's UFOs.
Well, except the fact that
the elephant in the room.
Aliens, excuse me, UFOs. But it might be that Kirsten Gillibrand is a candidate who has a good debate, and now we have a conversation focused around her and her merits and demerits as a candidate, and she's someone who's largely been ignored. Again, part of the reason why like I am against being like overly inclusive is because there are a lot of interesting and well-credentialed candidates who have not gotten their say. And so maybe Hickenlooper is a bad example of one to tease as like irrelevant because he is a governor of Colorado and that's like a fairly good credential, right? But, but I would rather have a conversation about like a Kirsten Gillibrand who has kind of traditional presidential credentials than a Swalwell or maybe than a...
Eric Swalwell really has it rough on today's podcast.
But I tell you why, though. I think other news organizations are like too afraid to say that this candidate doesn't really have anything useful to say and it's just running to be on TV more, which
we're
is not true of all
here
of them.
On this podcast.
We're brave. We speak hashtag truth.
All right. Well, I think we have exhausted this point. I'm also pretty sure I have a fever, so I hope this makes sense to everybody who's listening, because I'm totally sick right now.
This whole podcast was a fever dream by Galen.
Yeah. Outplay with It Was All a Dream.
In any case, let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.